Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Committee Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. We have a lot to cover today, including some, you know, very important discussion that we're going to have. And so on the first bill on the agenda is House File 4326, which is my bill. And just so members understand and the public understands, what we are going to do today, I have these two bills up, House File 4326 and House File 3980, and we are not intending to move those out today. We are going to be moving some amendments just to get them in the right shape, but our intention is to just take testimony today, and then tomorrow our intention is to amend the bills and move them. And then, so that is what we're doing, and I just wanted people to understand that. And we're going to start with these, and I'm going to just, even though I'm the author, I'm going to do it from here, if that's okay with members, because it's mostly going to be about taking testimony. And just so those of you who don't know, that's kind of unusual. A chair normally should go to the testifying table and let someone else take the gavel when it's the chair's bill. But I think in this case, we might be able to do it this way, but if anyone has any real objection to that, why, you know, let me know. Or if it becomes awkward. So the first bill then, I'm going to move House File 4326, and we're going to move that to be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means, correct? Yeah, eventually. Okay. And then we also have an author's amendment, which is the A3 amendment. And let me just take a quick look at this. So what the A3 is doing is it's removing part of the bill. So just so members understand, and just, you know, I want, you know, Jeremiah to be aware of this too. What we're doing is taking this bill and basically splitting it into two pieces just to move separately. So we have a vehicle bill in this committee, which is House File 3980. We thought we were going to need that bill to do the COVID-19 funding or to do the federal funds piece that we actually moved off the floor last night and got it out of the way. So we're going to use this vehicle instead to take half of this bill that I have brought before you as 4326. So is that kind of clear to everybody? So we're going to have two separate bills because there really are two separate issues. One is about emergency powers of the governor, and the other is this revolving loan fund. And so we just thought it would be just maybe more practical to do those things separately. So that's what we're doing. So the chair then moves the A3 amendment to put the bill in the shape in which I would like to have it considered. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. So now we're on 4326, and this one then is the public health emergency provision. And so just to give a brief explanation of this, it's when in Chapter 12, there's a Chapter 12 is a whole section about the governor's emergency powers. We don't normally deal with it in this committee. But there is, in Chapter 12, it gives the governor powers, certain powers in an emergency. So you'll see in the language of the bill that the governor may declare a peacetime emergency. And then it goes on to define that as an act of nature, a technological failure, malfunction, terrorist incident, etc. There's some lack of clarity about whether a public health emergency is included. I would argue that it already is, but at this time we really see the need to make that super clear, so that if the governor needs to exercise these powers, there's really no concern about whether he can legally do so. The second piece of this that's being changed in the bill is that these other peacetime emergencies, if you read the current language, It says on line 2.13, a peacetime emergency must not be continued for more than 5 days unless extended by resolution of the Executive Council up to 30 days. What the bill does is put in the language, except that a public health emergency may be continued up to 90 days. And this is because of the nature of a public health emergency, such as the one we might be looking at now. So I have people here from the Department of Health who could explain that, I think, a little bit better. Is somebody here that could, not yet, or, okay, I guess we're waiting. We're waiting for the testifier on that one. So, you know, we could, while we're waiting for a testifier on that one, or we could always lay it over and pick up the other bill if need be, but are there questions or discussion about any of this? And we will have some further explanation, I think, soon. All right, not seeing any. Okay. So why don't we just wait a moment or two here? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just sorry I was a few minutes late. When you say, I guess, is there a bill's author?
I am.
You are, yeah. Madam Chair. Yeah. The public health emergency, I know that that may be what we would have with a outbreak of a virus here, but I've also heard people refer to gun violence as a public health emergency and other things. So is there anywhere in statute where this is defined, what a public health emergency is defined as?
So that's a great question, Representative Munson. If you look at the...
Sorry.
if you look at the bill language, a public health emergency is well defined in the bill, and it is, I don't think that gun violence would fit under that.
That answers my question. Thank you.
Okay. But yeah. No, good. We want to make sure all this is really clear. And, you know, yeah. Okay, well, are there other questions from members or other discussion at this moment? Oh, Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you. Thanks for bringing the bill forward, Chair Liebling. You know, according to the analysis, it says the bill would appropriate a blank amount from the general fund to the health care response.
So, Representative Grunhagen, if you followed me, we amended 4326. Yep. And we amended it to take out the loan fund piece. So right now we're only talking, and I don't know if Representative Munson might have missed this too.
Yep.
What we've done is break this bill into two bills.
Okay.
So we used our vehicle. We're gonna put the loan fund language on the vehicle bill just for ease of keeping these things separate.
Yeah, and I voted for that, and I still didn't.
Yeah, and you voted for it. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
And so right now we're just talking about the healthcare,
okay. The
public health emergency piece.
Okay, thank you.
And just for everybody to know also, this had a hearing in GovOps this morning, the whole bill. There's a clone that is going through other committees, just for your knowledge. Sometimes we wish we could clone not just bills but people, right?
Uh-huh.
Just because we need to be in so many places
who
at the same time. Right, that is absolutely right. Who doesn't? Okay, I think what we'll do is we're going to lay this bill over just for a few minutes, and we will take up the other bill and proceed, because I see if we don't do that, we're going to get into trouble here. So 4326 is laid over. Okay. Now we have House File 3980, so the chair will move that House File 3980 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And once again, we're not intending to move the bill out today. So House File 3980. So there is an amendment to this bill, the DE4 author's amendment. And so the chair will move the DE4 amendment to get the bill in the order in which we would like, I would like to discuss it. And so again, members, what this is doing is just taking the language about the revolving account and putting it on this vehicle bill that we had from before. Any question about that? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you. So we are now talking about, I see that our testifier came in the room, but I think since we're on this bill now, this is 3980. This is now contains the language about the revolving account and loan program. So I think what I'll do is introduce this bill, and then we can talk first about the loan program, and then we'll go back and talk about the other bill about the emergency powers. So this now House File 3980 came out of the recognition that the emergency funding that we passed last night really doesn't do the entire job, because we have many entities in our state who also have to prepare for potential emergency. And these could include, as you all I'm sure recognize, could include hospitals, clinics, other healthcare providers, ambulance services, EMTs, and a whole host of folks that are part of our healthcare infrastructure, who may be called upon to, are certainly being called upon now to prepare, and could be called upon to do things beyond what they're usually doing. And so initially there was a proposal or a thought from the Senate about having some kind of a grant program. I have been made aware that the Senate maybe was finding that difficult to move forward. But the idea for a loan program was frankly my idea, and I think the Senate is interested in it as well, because we need to strike a careful balance here. I think all of us would say we don't want to have healthcare providers go out of business because they're unable to meet the sudden demand, say a cash flow demand. I think this might particularly pertain to some smaller providers, community health clinics, people out in rural areas that might suddenly find themselves in need of supplies, training, and other things that they just can't afford. At the same time, what we don't want to be doing is just taking taxpayer money and giving it to organizations that can afford their own stuff, who are in the business, after all, of providing health care. And so in order to try to strike a careful balance there of strengthening our public health system and our medical care system in ways that are very necessary and appropriate without just, you know, making the state into a piggy bank for people who don't need additional funding or could find other ways to finance their immediate needs, this is the thought that we came up with. So we're going to have some testimony about possible ways to do this. I am in no way saying that the form that this is in is the right format. I'm not an expert in how to put together loan funds and what the parameters of a loan fund should be, and so we've asked for expertise and assistance on that. And as I said in the Government Operations Committee this morning, I welcome input from all members who might have expertise in this about how to structure this properly to meet the goals that I have laid out, which I would expect would be shared goals between the House and Senate and between the Democrats and Republicans on striking the right balance to put money out there that we might need to protect our system without, you know, buying stuff that for private entities that otherwise don't need it. Yes. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Please. And so while you're on that topic, and I know you said the taxpayers should not be buying items for private business. No, it's not a piggy bank. I totally understand that sentiment and appreciate that. Just something that came up this weekend was a licensed family child care provider did contact me, very concerned, as you know, fear creates panic. People are, I hope they're stocking up on food instead of just toilet paper. But the cleaning supplies are very hard to find, and was concerned because by law they need to be sanitizing, keeping things clean, but there was bleach not to be found. And so, indeed, I verified and went, you know, just quickly online to some stores. And she's in Morris, so not in my area, but I went around. And, yes, those supplies were out. They were back in yesterday in Alexandria, right? But I'm concerned there. I did check Amazon, and the prices were pretty ridiculous. But that in time of a shortage, the market will respond accordingly. But if we could keep some of those, like in schools might have some issues, nursing homes, just I don't know if that's just some thoughts that I had.
Thank you very much for that, Representative Franson. I think that's a serious issue. I mean, what you've brought up there has more to do with the availability of supplies, but I think your point is well taken that there may be organizations that can't afford, you know, and I didn't mention nursing facilities, mm-hmm. which are, you know, one of the big areas of concern that, you know, we don't want to put people out of business because they don't have cash flow to buy, just the kind of things could be what you're talking about there as well. So I think that's a really important issue, and I'm not sure if that is completely answered with a revolving fund, but I think we need to keep that in mind. And part of, well, we'll talk when we get back to the emergency powers issue about some more about that, because, you know, regulations may need to be adjusted too at some point by under those emergency powers. But anyway, thank you very much for that comment. I appreciate that. I wonder if we could have our somebody come up from, I think we had the Department of Health was going to come and speak to the idea of the revolving loan fund. And also, members, let me just say a word as Ms. Kelly comes up to the table. Part of what we're doing, what I initially did in this language, you'll notice that it is kind of vague on the terms of, you know, like how long people would have to pay these back, what the interest rates would be. I didn't feel that I had the expertise to put that in initially, but I did not include anything about loan forgiveness. And the reason I didn't, even though I recognize that there may be some organizations that might have trouble repaying a loan, my thought was that if we structure this well, there may be opportunities if somebody is really in dire straits and can't repay a loan to come back to the legislature to have that loan forgiveness, that we or future legislature could always consider loan forgiveness in due course, so that I did not really think it was necessary to put it into this bill and have to then figure out what the parameters of that would be. So if members have comments on that was just my thought process, but I very much want to bring all members in on this. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, in agriculture, we deal with a lot of biologicals, whether it was the avian influenza piece, bovine tuberculosis, et cetera. And just a suggestion, we have a rapid response account. We also have the RFA, which we all voted on not too long ago. Mr. Colby Sullivan, Madam Chair, he's our lead nonpartisan staff researcher there, and also on Ways and Means. So I believe you know Mr. Sullivan. He would be a great resource, I believe, that would help as far as offering up different ideas and suggestions on how to structure this, similar to what we did in agriculture, I believe, could be helpful.
Great. Thank you for that, Representative Hamilton. And we have been reaching out and trying to look at what other funds are out there. And you know, I was told when we started to write this language that this is not the first time that the state would have some kind of loan fund. So there are models to follow, and we can consider the pros and cons. And I'm hoping that's kind of some of what we're going to do today. In addition, of course, everyone has noticed that there's no appropriation in here. And what I would like to do is, you know, the blank appropriation is because we don't yet know what would be appropriate to put in there, what the need is, and what the willingness of the legislature is to fill that blank for loan funds. So we're going to hear some testimony today, I hope, on some of the needs as well as some of the ideas for perhaps structuring the loan fund. So, Ms. Kelly, welcome to the committee. Can you talk a little bit about, right now we're on House File 3980. We're going to move back to the emergency piece later, but we're on the loan fund now.
Sure.
And did you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Margaret Kelly, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Health. And thank you, Chair Liebling, for bringing this forward. We have experience at the Department of Health in operating revolving loan programs in our Office of Rural Health. And so we think that we could stand something like this up relatively quickly. We could streamline an application for providers and organizations that we could get the information we need to make a determination about their eligibility. We would look for all of you, we would look to all of you to help us determine what the parameters are in terms of under what conditions would you want someone to get a loan, for what purpose would you want them to have a loan, how long you would want them to be paying back the loan. Clearly, a no-interest loan would be easier. Saying a low-interest loan would leave it up to us to decide what level of interest is low interest. So if you could define that, that would be great. But we have heard from the healthcare system, from hospitals, from federally qualified healthcare centers, community clinics, nursing home providers, that they anticipate that they may have costs associated to staff augmentation, that they may have so many folks within their system that they have to run double shifts or pay overtime. And so they did not anticipate those sorts of costs, and they may have cash flow needs because of it, that they may need to acquire additional personal protective equipment while we are working to access supplies out of the strategic national stockpile. In the short term, they may be out looking for that equipment, that they may need to acquire other equipment as well, ventilators, or I am not going to get the name correctly. I'm sure there's someone in the room who could tell me what an ECMO is. There's a much longer name for it, but to help people with in the ICU. They may need have capital costs as they do changes within their facility to accommodate people who need isolation. And so those are things that our healthcare system may need, and that we would want to be able to ensure that they're able to deliver the services we need in a timely fashion. And we appreciate considering this strategy to get the funds out to them.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Kelly. So I take it from what you said, I'm glad to know that the department, you know, is kind of prepared to administer this. This isn't kind of outside of something. It isn't a new strange animal to the department having a fund like this. When you talk about what the interest, low interest, no interest, is it just as easy to administer if there is some interest rate? I understand what you're saying, that you want us to determine what that is. But is it easier to, in terms of administration of the loan fund, if you have a no interest, then you don't have to deal with that at all. If there's some interest, then you have to, the interest has to be calculated and collected and something like that. So does the department already do this for interest-bearing loans?
Madam Chair, I phoned a friend.
Okay, excellent. Welcome to the committee.
So, Madam Chair, and my friend just emailed me an answer, knowing that some questions might come up. So for the record, my name is Diane Rydrick. I'm the Director of the Health Policy Division at the Department of Health. And our Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, which is in my division, is the program that has administered revolving loan funds before. There was formerly an electronic health record revolving loan fund that our Office of Rural Health and Primary Care administered. I believe that one was a no-interest loan fund, so we wouldn't have had experience administering a revolving loan that had an interest rate. That said, I don't think that would be any more difficult mechanically for us to do. I don't think it's that difficult to calculate what the interest rate would be, but to Deputy Commissioner Kelly's point, it's just the determination of what is a low interest rate. And having that kind of discretion, I think, is a little less comfortable for us. It would be, I think, preferable to have it either set or set by the legislature or linked to an interest rate or set at no interest rate.
Okay, thank you for that. Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. Just a thought that occurred to me. It's my kind of assessment that the inclusion of an interest rate in this bill is like all interest rates, right, to ensure that we are paid back the money for this loan so that there's some type of incentive. But an idea that just occurred to me is that what if we were to structure, well, not only delineate in the bill what would be considered a low interest rate, but also what if we just said, you know, there's no interest if paid back in full within 12 to 18 months or something like that. So that way they still have that definite deadline and an interest rate would kick in and in that incentive to repay the money from this loan account. So that idea just occurred to me, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much for that thought. So I think what we could do then is, let me just ask while we've got these testifiers here, are there particular conditions that you would look for? I mean, knowing, you know, this is a pretty special kind of fund and a pretty special kind of need. And one of the things that I think we could probably all agree on is that we want this to move quickly. If the need is there, the money needs to get out. And, of course, there's, you know, for people to actually get the money in their hands and then buy what they need to have and get things on the ground could happen very, very quickly. So are there particular features of this fund that you see in here that you don't like or that you would like to see that you think would be helpful? And I'm just, since we are the HHS Finance Committee, kind of from the point of view of the health need that this is about, are there things that we think we need to be sure to include or not include?
Madam Chair, I'll start and say that I think
Ms.
that
Kelly.
There are a lot of parameters, there are broad parameters in this bill that gives us the discretion to identify where there are priorities in our healthcare system that we would first direct loans to and determine what the needs are that we are hearing about as we have regular conversations with our healthcare system across the state.
Okay. Other questions for members? Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'm wondering, does the department have any idea what will be, it just left my brain.
Like how much money we need?
Not just how much money we need, but the direction each, how we divide that out. You know, we've got different size hospitals. We've got some urgent care, you know, smaller hospitals. What's that? How do we allocate it? And critical access hospitals that are going to probably be in real dire straits to handle any of this.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair, we have gotten some guidance from the Hospital Association in terms of categories of hospitals, ranging from your small critical access hospitals to your larger Minnesota Fairview hospitals. And the needs would vary depending on, I would think, the size and the cash flow of the facility, but also perhaps the extent to which, at some point in time, I assume the healthcare system may start to designate where patients should go. And maybe that is where we need to focus funds, which is why it is helpful to have some flexibility in here to direct funds based on needs. Our long-term care facilities, and looking at what has happened in other states, in Washington State in particular, the need for staffing is in long-term care facilities as well as in the clinics and the hospitals for doing the sampling. And so we may need to be providing a lot of assistance to our long-term care facilities to maintain their ability to isolate patients and to maintain their staffing levels so that those patients get the care and attention that they need.
Yeah. Does that help, Representative Keel? And Ms. Kelly, if you could pull the mic just a bit closer.
Sure. Sorry.
Her gentle voice. Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if it would be possible to maybe hear from the Hospital Association or our long-term care groups just to see what their thoughts are on what they're going to need and how it's going to look.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Keel. That's absolutely our intention to do that. So as soon as we were going to call for those groups to come down and talk to us about exactly that. So very much what we're going to do today. Okay, are there other questions for members? All right, seeing none, thank you very much. Appreciate your help. And so with that, I'm going to see if there are members of the public. I don't know if the Hospital Association or other groups that wanted to come and talk to us kind of about where they see the need and what kinds of parameters they might be looking for in the fund and how, you know, and perhaps kind of help us understand how much of an appropriation we might need to put in the fund to meet the needs of the state. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. And I want to say up front that we really sincerely do appreciate the work of Chair Liebling to try to move a second bill through the legislative process. We know the first bill funding the Department of Health was extremely important, as the first focus is on containment, you know, trying to keep the spread of the coronavirus and our public health, trying to keep it contained. But we also know that this is going to quickly, sadly, move to phase two, which is the care and treatment of very significantly sick individuals who are going to need a high level of hospital care. And to be frank with you, we are very concerned that a low interest loan or even a no interest loan program is probably not going to be sufficient. We really believe the hospitals and as well as nursing homes, as well as the clinics, are probably going to need some type of grant program. So doing a low interest loan or no interest loan might be appropriate for longer term expenditures. For instance, if a hospital does want to renovate an ICU unit, something that has a depreciation over maybe a 10-year time frame. But we need grant money now to particularly work on staffing and personal protective equipment and things that the hospitals need right now. This is a global healthcare crisis, and I'd like to just share with you a couple of examples from the staffing perspective. So the first thing that we learned in a phone call with the Department of Health on Monday is that the testing is going to be moving towards the clinics around the state. So the clinics are going to be responsible for the testing. So our members now are thinking about, do they need to move to some type of drive-up testing type of units, because we don't want to have our staffs get infected. So we have to figure out where this testing is going to take place. What happened in California, and we are learning quickly from other states, the coronavirus spread to one hospital, and they had to quarantine 200 hospital workers. So if you can imagine a hospital that then has to take out their employees on quarantine, how does that hospital manage? So the first thing we're trying to deal with right now is the testing. So can we get that out of the clinics and out of the hospitals so we can keep our employees safe? The next focus has to be on protecting and training our workforce. There are shortages of personal protective equipment now. We are hearing from our members that they desperately want to order as much as they can, and there is some still available. We also have to train our employees how to use the PPE. Some of them are not as familiar with it. So we need to train our staff. We need to get the personal protective equipment. We also need to figure out that as our employees get sick, we're likely to have to hire additional employees or encourage our employees who are healthy to work overtime shifts. So our hospitals now are really in what I call the incident command mode type of figuring out how they can beef up their staffs and how they can pay overtime. And this is also going to require us to be able to triage the 80% of the patients that can stay home. So we're talking about, do we have to have call centers? Do we need to use telemedicine? How do we communicate with the folks that can stay home with this flu and not have to come to the clinics and hospitals. So all of our members are kind of trying to beef up their call lines right now, beef up their phone triage so that we can keep the relatively healthier flu patients at home and then prepare our hospitals and clinics for the sicker patients. And then the last element of staffing that I want to mention is EMS and transportation. So last Friday, we had a meeting of our chief medical officers from around the state, and I really would like to share with you an example that they shared with us that I thought was really pretty informative. So let's just say, hypothetically, that, and you'll hear from the nursing homes, let's just say that a nursing home is quarantined and needs to shut down. And let's just say, hypothetically, they have 30 very sick patients that need to be moved out for care and treatment. So we would have to have EMS be properly in their protective, personal protective equipment. We'd have to take those patients and we would have to move them to various hospitals that had A, different levels of care, and who had a bed open and who had the equipment that they needed. So we would be moving patients around. I heard the other thing that could happen is some of our more higher tertiary care hospitals may have to move patients that are healthier to some of our critical access hospitals. So what we may have is a real flow of patients moving from one hospital to another hospital as they need higher levels of care. So I mentioned this to you because there's a lot of coordination that is going on right now in our members, lots of conversations, lots of emphasis on staffing and transportation, and I'm afraid that a long-term loan forgiveness program is much more about how do you remodel your facilities. We're talking about a grant program that would be used now, and I recognize the need for accountability and appreciate if the department needs to put guidelines on this, parameters, what the money can be used for, if there's some type of invoice system. I get the need for accountability in government, but I can't stress to you all enough how important it is that we move something forward quickly. This is happening even as we speak, and our members are preparing right now for what I would call an extraordinary surge amount of patients that could potentially be coming our way. So I'm here for questions, as you hear from the nursing homes and others, but I just want to stress to you all that I think a loan program alone without a grant program is going to be insufficient. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Do you have an estimate of how much, I know this is very difficult, yeah, but you know, how much money needs to be in our loan program, even though you don't like it being a loan? But honestly, from my point of view, it would function just the same way going out the door. The only question is on the back end,
yeah,
that people would have to have the expectation that, yeah, you know, that it would need to be paid back. And as I said to the committee in the outset, I think there's no reason the legislature couldn't forgive loans in certain necessary situations. However, anyway, but the same question is really, how much money do you think will be needed to be available to make these system improvements happen?
Yeah. Madam Chair, and I know this is a little off topic, but I think it is important to put into context. The median hospital income margin last year was 1.7%. It was down from 2.3% the previous year. 26% drop in our median operating margin. We have 27 hospitals that have negative operating margins. Most of them are in rural Minnesota. So I don't want to leave the committee with the impression that hospitals have a lot of extra resources right now to help pay for this. So now to try to answer your question, we have been asking our members to put together their estimates, and it's very hard for them to do because they don't know exactly how many patients are going to be taken care of. So they're looking at it as saying, well, if we get an extra 15 patients, it's this amount. If we get an extra 100 patients, it's this amount. It's very hard for them to put together an estimate. If I were in your shoes, and a recommendation may be to sort of phase this in, is there an opportunity to have one bucket that is grant dollars and one bucket that is loan forgiveness start out. And I appreciate your comment that we may have to come back next year with expenses and do some type of settle up type of process. But you're budgeting for today, and I know that doesn't work. So my members are very hesitant to give a dollar amount. I think that starting out with some amount in grant funding would be helpful.
Are there questions from members? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Krinke, have you factored in the federal dollars that'll be coming to, and then also combined with the state that we just passed?
Yeah,
Ms. Krinke.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, fortunately or unfortunately, most of the federal money was given to the CDC to develop vaccines and money for new medicines, and I think that that is certainly appropriate. The other thing that is funded is our public health infrastructure. Not very much was allocated to frontline providers, hospitals, doctors, clinics, ambulances. So it was a different focus with the federal money. We were a little disappointed with what the feds did in terms of some of the allocations. The department, and as I said when I started, the $20 million that was allocated to the Department of Health is basically funding public health needs. So the answer is there's not much there for the healthcare provider community.
So I'm going to go to Representative Keel, and then we do have other testifiers who want to talk about different aspects. Representative Keel.
Great. You know, I keep thinking if we have the right equipment on the front end, that helps us to contain this. Yeah. If we have areas where people are going, that helps us to contain the spread of this virus, which I understand is difficult. But I will certainly suggest and reiterate what Representative Hamilton said about the ag loans and how the all of that has worked. I think that's a good pattern to look at. However, I am really kind of concerned about how we pay for whether it's patients or how this is just going to be so sudden that it's going to be really hard for facilities that have low margins anyway, much less, I guess I'm thinking rural hospitals and nursing homes. There isn't going to be the beds. There isn't going to be the area. I mean, folks, it gets a little scary when, fortunately, we probably won't have any major storms, but my husband was laying in an ICU bed, and we were trying to decide how to get him to what hospital if there was a bed and could we physically get there because of the winter weather. So, and we're not talking about one person here. We're talking about multitudes. So I don't know. I think I'm going to walk away with more questions than I have. I think that's probably why we're all kind of just sitting here going, how do we deal with this? So, but I think we have to think in terms of how we can cover some of the costs, especially for the protective wear, for the facilities and EMTs and that type of thing.
And Representative Keel, the money that went out yesterday does actually a big chunk of that. I forget exactly how much is for personal protective equipment. So there is some of that is in process, and I guess I'm not entirely clear, like, who has to buy their own and who that exactly goes to. But, you know, I mean, I think we all are sharing that concern. It's really, and, you know, my thinking about this is that absolutely those providers who are on small margins, who are, this isn't part of their, you know, nursing homes don't expect to have to deal with what happened in Washington State.
No.
So, but on the other hand, you know, I mean, some organizations are much more able financially to do what they need to do than others. So that's why I definitely think we need money available to push out to make sure that organizations aren't overwhelmed. So thank you for that. I think we have other testifiers.
Thank you,
Ms. Krinke. I'm sorry. Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I'm just sort of formulating some things in my mind here, and I recognize that you're asking for grants, which are public dollars to assist in this, you know, possibly catastrophic situation. And those are public dollars that would not be paid back. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes. I mean, I don't want to say that there couldn't be some type of loan forgiveness program too, but our members are stressing that they need grant dollars that would not be paid back. So, yes.
Okay. May I continue? I guess I can. So, and you mentioned that profits were down perhaps 1 point.
Margins.
Not or margins, profit. Excuse me. So how much does that, would you say approximately in dollars, what would that amount be when you say that margins are down?
Ms. Krenke.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I can certainly provide that to you. We do a financial report every year for the preceding year's margins, and we have it by both percentage as well as a hard dollar amount. I don't have that for 140 hospitals in my head, but we do a report annually on the hospital margins, both as a percentage and as a dollar amount.
May I continue? Thank you. So of that, those margins, how much of that would you say, and I don't know the structure, I don't know exactly how this works, but of that margin, how much of that goes towards any bonuses for administration or executives, anything like that?
Ms. Krenke?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the CEO salaries and compensation, because all Minnesota hospitals are nonprofit, it is publicly available on the 990 forms as well. So we don't have shareholders. We don't have stock options. So the salaries of hospital CEOs are publicly available information. And so if there's a hospital CEO in particular that you're interested in, I mean, we can certainly get you that information. It is publicly available, but there are no stock options. There's no transfer of ownership or wealth of the hospital. So.
May I continue?
Well, Representative Kunishpini, we have other testifiers.
Okay, just
and I one more.
Okay, one more question.
Members who have questions.
So, I guess I'm just a little concerned that we would be giving public dollars that were not that don't need to be paid back when perhaps some of these executives and some of these CEOs are making millions of dollars, and perhaps what we need to think about is. Perhaps using some of those fundings for matching grants, if they're willing to put their money where their mouth is and make sure that our community members and our people are being covered as best they can. It's going to be a tough road, and it would be great if everybody pitched in on that. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Well, okay, Ms. Greenpeace.
It's important, though.
We're going down a road here that we don't need to, but
and
please.
That's what I was trying to make the point that right now our hospitals are really focused on trying to save lives, and we can have another discussion another day about management of hospitals, but our goal right now is to try to save lives. So thank you.
All right, but okay, we're going to take one more from Representative Haley, and then we're going to go to another testifier. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and as this is a finance committee, Ms. Krenke, thank you. 140 hospitals. Do you have a recommendation on how we would determine which hospitals would get funds? And I'm thinking in the sense of efficiency of our resources. You talked about this response. Do the sickest people get congregated, for example, at certain facilities so that we put most of our resources there versus divvying up across 140 hospitals? Is that not effective? Has the association thought about a plan?
Madam
Krenke.
Madam Chair, Representative Haley, we have thought about should there be a base allocation for a critical access hospital that they could apply for one level. Is there another level for the PPS hospitals? Do we ask the systems to pull together their hospitals and say this one hospital would be the designated location for the sickest patients, and then the other hospitals within their system would care for the less sick but still sick patients? So those discussions are going on. With a grant program, we felt that if you had money allocated on a per hospital basis, they could apply based on the criteria set up by the Department of Health. They would say what expenses were deemed allowable. Could a hospital then apply for a grant under that designated bucket? So the critical access hospitals would be in one bucket, and there are 78 critical access hospitals, and there are 50 larger PPS hospitals. So you could set up the criteria for those two buckets of hospitals.
Okay, if we could, thank you. Okay, thank you, Ms. Krenke. Is there someone else who wanted to testify? Please come down. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Danny Ackert, and I am the Director of Public Policy at the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. We represent Minnesota's 17 federally qualified health centers, referred to as FQHCs, that collectively treat the primary medical, dental, and behavioral health care needs of roughly 200,000 Minnesotans. Minnesota's FQHCs, similar to all healthcare providers in the state, as the Hospital Association just provided a lot of testimony on, are currently taking all necessary measures to prepare for, prevent, and respond to the spread of COVID-19 in Minnesota. The rapid and novel development of COVID-19 requires immediate and uniquely specialized services to stop the spread of the virus and treat, screen, and isolate infected patients. This situation has placed many primary care providers in a position of needing direct support to properly provide the precise level and accurate types of care needed to keep both patients and providers safe. House File 3980 proposes the revolving account and loan program, and we support its intent and the allowable uses for loans as a valuable approach to ensuring that Minnesota's healthcare providers on the front lines in primary care of COVID-19 are properly and fairly supported to meet the needs of their patients and their communities in this emergency situation. I have to stress that staffing and screening, the Hospital Association provided a lot of information already on what that staffing and screening requirements look like and where that happens and how we support that. I have to stress that again. And we also share concerns that were already raised and have been discussed previously now on paying back loans in an emergency situation, especially for primary care providers like FQHCs that operate on already relatively razor-thin margins. In addition to the current allowable uses for loans listed in the revolving account and loan program, we urge the committee to consider including patient outreach and special support for the treatment of uninsured and underinsured patients. There are many unique needs in response to COVID-19 that need critical attention in Minnesota. We must not forget our most vulnerable. We look forward to working with this committee to assist in the quick development and finalization of the revolving loans program. And we do have, and we will, and are currently developing specific information, especially around costs, to some of the other representatives and committee members' questions. We will have those details for this committee, and currently generating those right now. So thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. With that, I do stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ackert. Representative Jordan.
Yes, I'm really Madam Chair, I'm really glad you brought up the issue of our underinsured and uninsured. A question I have is related to, as we set up triage hospitals, what are we going to do about hospitals that are out of network for individuals? And would additional costs incurred be covered by this revolving loan, or how are we accounting for that?
So, Mr. Ackert, I don't know if you have an answer for that, but go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Jordan, I do not believe that I have the information. I'm not sure if I would be the right one to answer that. I know that that's a concern of for our members in regards to how that process might work as on the front lines. If we encounter a patient who screens positive, if we screen them, how that process work from there. So we share that concern and we'll provide the information we can to help on the primary care end, mm-hmm. while this committee to put this program to, together with the best information.
All right, sorry. Thank you. And Representative Schultz.
Just want to answer Representative Jordan's question. So we just drafted a bill this weekend to cover out-of-network care and other things. So the plans would be required to cover that if there was a quarantine or it was out of their control where they go to get care. So that bill is being fast-tracked at the revisor's office. So hopefully we'll see that soon.
Thank you.
Okay, and then Representative Cantrell was next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Ackert. So, Is it fair to assume that that a lot of FQHCs are anticipating that there's going to be a pretty substantial, as we kind of assess that, there are likely to be more cases of COVID-19 in Minnesota, so there's likely to be a more substantial demand on the resources of FQHCs? Madam Chair, if you have an answer for that.
Madam Chair, Representative Cantrell, our members are in the position right now that it is possible and also plausible that there will be many more cases, and that from their perspective as a primary care provider, the demand is going to increase because they do not want to be in a situation where they are not prepared, given the fact that their mission is to serve everyone and anyone who comes to their door. So we are currently preparing for the significant increase of patients coming in who are either flu or COVID-19, and we need to be able to treat them.
All right, thank you. I have Representative Halverson next, and then we're going to lay this bill over and go back to the other bill. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the bill is certainly raising some important questions, but with regard to Representative Jordan's question, which I think is a good one, the other thing that we have to be aware of, and I think it goes to hospitals and clinics as well, that the private entities are doing a lot of their own planning, and I think that it's going to be good for us to figure out what all the planning is taking place. With regard to the health plans, I know I've received numerous alerts that there are plans in Minnesota that are covering at no cost testing and a few other things. So, and I think that was actually at the urging of the CDC. And so finding out how everybody's playing their role in this is important. So that's actually happening currently in Minnesota.
Thank you for that, Representative Halverson. So, boy, at the end of this, maybe we'll have a more functional healthcare system. You never know. So with that, members, I will lay over House File 3980, and we're planning to take this up again tomorrow. And then I would take from the table House File 4326, which was the emergency powers piece, and the Department of Health is here. And if they would come down and just give us a bit of testimony. We do have other bills we're going to take up yet today, but we didn't have the opportunity to hear from them. And I especially want to hear, I'll just let Ms. Kelly make her presentation. And I had explained before what we're trying to do here, but you might want to address the 90-day piece. So Ms. Kelly, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Margaret Kelly, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Health, and I appreciate Representative Liebling bringing this bill forward. The governor currently has, under Chapter 12, the emergency powers under an act of nature. We would consider the virus to be an act of nature, but we just think it's important to clarify that an act of nature is also a public health emergency. Rather than have any questions, the governor's powers are broad and unusual in that he or she would be able to take action without conferring with the legislature. That's the point of emergency powers, and we don't want any question about whether or not it's the right time to do it. So incorporating into the authority for emergency powers a public health emergency would be prudent. The sorts of things he may do may be waiving some of the requirements when we would contract with people. So rather than having to go through an RFP that may take months, we could immediately reach out and engage someone to provide, for example, a nurse triage line without having to go through an RFP process. That's an example of a power that the governor may invoke under a public health emergency. We also are recommending that a public health emergency, if declared, lasts for 90 days as opposed to 30 days. Under current law, the governor can declare a public health emergency. It lasts for 5 days. If it needs to go longer than 5 days, the executive council of the state, which is the governor, the secretary of the state, and the attorney general, can meet and convene and extend that for an additional 30 days. We are recommending that if it needs to be extended for longer than 30 days, that executive council be able to extend it for 90 days. happy to answer any
and
questions.
Ms. Kelly, could you kind of explain why you need 90 if it's a public health emergency as opposed to what's already in law for other kinds of peacetime emergencies? I alluded
sure,
to that,
Madam
but I
Chair.
Think you're better prepared to answer.
With a natural disaster, it comes and it happens and it goes, and we are able to quickly recover. With a virus outbreak of this sort, it starts slow and it builds and then it tapers off. And it could be that we are just reaching the peak of an outbreak when that 30 days would come. It's been about 2 weeks since the commissioner sat down with the governor and the leaders of the House and the Senate to say we are likely going to see cases in Minnesota. We should start talking when we're calm and can think about what we need. And now we have reported cases already here. So we're 2 weeks into that discussion, and that would be halfway through a declaration of an emergency.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Are there questions? Ms. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in today in Rochelle, New York, due to the 173 cases, Governor Cuomo, under his authority in the emergency, public emergency plan, called in the National Guard. Could you just kind of break down to the public? Because I've gotten some comments of people being like, oh my gosh, this is like, you hear the National Guard, people start freaking out. Like, what does that mean? Does our governor have the ability to call in the National Guard? If the National Guard was called in, under what circumstances, and how would that look to a city or township or whatnot?
Ms. Kelly?
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative. Every state's emergency powers are different, and in some states, the governor needs to declare an emergency in order for funding to start flowing. We passed a bill yesterday. That's not the case in Minnesota, but the governor does have the authority to call in the National Guard under emergency powers, and so that is one thing that he would be able to do if it was needed. I could envision perhaps the governor would need to call the National Guard to help staff nursing homes or to help transport patients, something of that nature. There are a variety of things that the National Guard could do to help us out in the time of an emergency.
Okay, Representative Franson. Okay. All right, seeing no other questions, so I don't know if there's the other bill, the one with the loan fund, I think there's, we need to probably wait on. Even though it was my intention to not move this one, I wonder if there's any objection to if we just go ahead and move it out, since it's now separate, this emergency powers piece. I see nods. Does any, is there any objection? I know Representative Schumacher's not in the room here today, but is there any reason to wait? I mean,
where is this?
This would be, Representative Keel, this would be going to Ways and Means. So I believe so, right? Ways and Means for the emergency powers?
Yes.
Yes. So it does have another stop.
So it wouldn't be going to HHS policy?
That's a great question, Representative Keel. I spoke to Representative Moran. I know she is. Oh, there she is. She's here. This is a bill that it's a little questionable whether it would have to. It's not because it's Chapter 12. It's not. And so her preference was not to hear it. We spoke about it, if the minority is uncomfortable with moving it because I did say we wouldn't be, I won't. But if there's no reason to hold it up, and given kind of the nature of how fast things seem to be moving, and just so people know, we've had a couple new cases today, and they're pretty serious cases. So I would really, if we can, if there's no objection, I think it would be a good idea to move it forward.
Madam Chair,
Representative Keel.
I think we're okay with that.
All right, thank you very much. Well, with that, members, the chair renews her motion that House File 4326, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much for that, members. So with that, we're going to take up the next bill, that will be House File 2581, Representative 3322, Representative Kunesh-Podein. All right. Thanks for your patience, testifiers. And Representative Kunesh-Podein moves House File 3322, and I think it's going to the General Register, to be re-referred to the General Register.
Yes, so, please.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Great. Well, this bill before us would broaden the state statute to comply with federal law and make sure that any woman that is diagnosed with breast or cervical cancer through a CDC National Breast and Cervical Cancer Early Detection Program would automatically be eligible for Medicaid and for her cancer treatment coverage. Under the current law, a medical assistant provides services to persons with breast or cervical cancer who have been screened by the Minnesota Breast and Cervical Cancer Control Program. And then this program, referred to as SAGE, receives funding for breast and cervical cancer screening and diagnosis from Federal Center for Disease Center and Prevention, the CDC. This bill will allow MA coverage to be provided to persons diagnosed with breast or cervical cancer by any CDC-funded breast and cervical cancer control program in the state, and is not limited to MA coverage just MA coverage to just persons who are diagnosed by SAGE program.
Thank you.
And I do have two testifiers who have promised to be quick.
All right. Very good. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Emily Myatt. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. We're here today to testify in support of House File 3322. We know many barriers exist to cancer screenings and treatment, and that's why the CDC has funded states and tribal organizations to screen low-income, underinsured, and uninsured Minnesota women. Federal law says that any woman diagnosed through the CDC program is automatically eligible for Medicaid for her treatment. The bill before you today focuses solely on making sure women diagnosed through existing screening programs, both funded by the CDC, have access to the cancer treatment they need. Many of these women would already be eligible for Medicaid, but we want to make sure that no woman falls through the gaps. What good is a mammogram or cervical cancer screening if once diagnosed, you can't access the cancer care you need? So by supporting the bill, you're making sure that our state law conforms with federal law and that all women diagnosed through a CDC-funded program have access to the cancer care she needs. You've received a letter of support on this issue that includes the support of more than 20 organizations, including the Masonic Cancer Center, Mayo Clinic, the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers, the Minnesota Medical Association, and the Minnesota Hospital Association. The Minnesota Chippewa Tribe has also passed a resolution in support of this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, and welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, hello. My name is Melissa Buffalo. I am the Deputy Director with the American Indian Cancer Foundation. I am an enrolled member of the Meskwaki Nation in Iowa. The American Indian Cancer Foundation is a national nonprofit established to address the tremendous cancer inequities faced by American Indian communities. We are based out of Minneapolis. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 3322, legislation against remove barriers to treatment for women diagnosed with breast or cervical cancer. ACAF receives federal funds from the CDC's National Breast and Cervical Cancer Early Detection Program to do targeted breast and cervical cancer screenings for urban American Indian women. Screener Circle is a program here in Minneapolis working with the Native American Community Clinic to get more women screened for cancer. As you heard, American Indian women are less likely to be screened for cancer and more likely to be diagnosed. Prevention is the best way to treat cancer. Screener Circle serves about 8 women a month. However, the way statute is currently stated means that if a woman is diagnosed through the program, she wouldn't automatically be eligible for treatment, even though federal law says she would be. These women could go to the SAGE screening program. We want to remove as many barriers as possible to preventative cancer screenings, and Screener Circle meets women where they are. Please help us make sure the women diagnosed through Screener Circle can access the care they need. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Kunesh-Podein, did you want to add anything?
Just that there is no fiscal cost to this. There's zero cost to it. It's just allowing folks to access other programs as needed, and so this would not cost us anything.
Okay, thank you. Questions for members? Representative Akam.
No question, really just a comment. As a cancer survivor myself, I know how important not only diagnosis but treatment is, and our treatments have come so far, so we all should be able to benefit from those improvements. So thank you for the bill, and thank you for your work on it.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify for or against the bill? All right, seeing none. So Representative Kunesh-Podein will renew her motion that House File 3322 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We have the next one would be Representative Morrison, and I don't know if she, I know she was presenting in another committee. So I think we're going to just have to take a little bit of a pause here. I think Mr. McQuillan went to find her, and so that we can hear House File 2581. And my understanding is we might be moving the other bill, the Fisher bill, House File 4013, to tomorrow's agenda. But so we'll just wait for a moment here and see if we can get Representative Morrison. Oh, here she is. Excellent.
Oh, thank God.
The fear. Representative Morrison, welcome to the committee. The chair will move House File 2581 to be re-referred to Ways and Means, right? Laid over for possible inclusion. Okay, so to be laid over. So welcome.
Thank
Go
you,
ahead
Madam
and
Chair.
Present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thanks, Team Festive and HHS Finance. Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 2581. This is a bill that was part of House File 1 last year but never got its own hearing, so we are delighted to be here today. Quite simply, this bill appropriates money in order to help families defray the cost of diapers by helping food shelves to purchase diapers and stock them. There are no public programs that help reduce the cost of diapers, and they are a relatively expensive necessity. More than one in three children in Minnesota under age five live in low-income households. Most child care centers require parents to provide a week supply of diapers for each child. So if parents can't afford diapers, they can't get child care and go to work. This contributes to maternal depression and increases illness and infection in babies and young children. So I have two outstanding testifiers here to say more about the program.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Roche, and I represent a group of leaders that participated in the Policy Fellows Program at the Humphrey School at the University of Minnesota. Our cross-sector group of government, nonprofit, and business leaders, including representatives from Cargill, Target, and Best Buy, worked on a project a few years ago to address the diaper need for low-income families. And we're very excited to support this legislation to directly address this diaper need across Minnesota. And here's some facts about diaper need, and Representative Morris had a few of these, and I'm going to go into depth a little bit more. In Minnesota, more than one in three low-income families report struggling to afford the $80 monthly cost per child for diapers. There is increased illness and infection in children whose parents have to reuse diapers or keep the child in a dirty diaper too long. And research conducted by the National Diaper Bank through Yale University's Moms Partnership reported a strong correlation between diaper need and maternal depression. And there are no federal or state programs that directly address the cost of diapers, and funds from many work support programs such as SNAP and WIC cannot be used to buy diapers. And the lack of diapers affects children's ability to go to childcare, where many providers require at least 1 week supply in advance of diapers, making it more difficult for parents to go to work. So this $260,000 appropriation for diapers to food shelves can reach all 87 Minnesota counties and distribute up to 1 million diapers per year. I urge you all to support this efficient and effective approach to addressing the diaper need, because it reaches low-income families where they're already turning for help. Through this appropriation, Minnesota can again be a leader in supporting healthy, and financially stable children and families, which is the foundation of our state's success. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have at this time.
All right. Thank you very much. And is there another testimony? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Peter Whitetock, Government Relations with Hunger Solutions Minnesota. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. So we are in full support of House File 2581 that would provide $260,000 to food shelves to purchase diapers to distribute to low-income families. This would allow for the continuation of a very successful investment made in 2017 in the legislative session that led to $45,000 distributed to food shelves in 68 Minnesota counties that allowed distribution of 346,000 diapers to families in the first round of funding. Food shelves were able to purchase additional diapers to help when they ran out of their donated supply, and in some cases help food shelves that have never been able to have donated diapers be able to purchase them and provide them for their clients. Renewing this funding helps us reach many low-income Minnesotans across the state in need and improve child and family health and financial stability. We encourage your support for the bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And Representative Morrison, I see there's an A1 amendment in the packet, and I assume that's an author's amendment that we need to adopt. I see it. Okay. Ms. Pugnelli.
Madam Chair, members, this is a technical amendment to update the appropriation for the second year of the biennium.
Okay. So we need to adopt this amendment. So the chair moves the A1 amendment. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. So are there any questions from members? Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify for or against House File 2581? All right, I'm not seeing any, so the chair will renew the motion that House File 2581, as amended, be recommended to be referred to, where were we? Oh, it's laid over. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So the bill is laid over for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget bill. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
So, okay. So, members, we are going to be able to take up the final bill on our agenda, which is House File 4013, Representative Fisher. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And let's see. House File 4013 is going where? Okay, so this one also will be, the motion is let it be laid over for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget bill. So let's see, are there any amendments? I don't think so. So Representative Fisher, please go ahead and present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File number 4013. This is a bill that does several different things. Number one, it changes the limit as to when the health department can step in to address issues where lead is occurring. Right now the measure is at 15. It would allow the health department to step in at the levels down to level 5 going up from there. The other thing it does, it also expands the areas that they're able to address. Right now this, and where this bill originally came from, was information I learned from the issue around water gremlin up in our area in the northeast suburbs over here in St. Paul. Is water gremlin is a company that originally was polluting the atmosphere for 17 years with cancer-causing chemicals way above their limit. During the process while that was going on, the health department found out that there was a problem with lead, where the company was not using proper lead protocol, and lead was ending up in the homes of the employees. Out of 100 children tested, 24% of the kids were coming up with elevated levels of lead. During that process, it was discovered that the way the law is laid out right now, there is no way that the health department can order a company legally to go in and clean up the lead that their employees brought home. The practices were that the employees would go to work in a lead environment. There was no cleanup facility there, so as a result, the lead was collected in the homes, and then that led to the elevated lead levels in the children. So what we also did as part of this process here is change the responsibility so that the health department would have clear authority to go in to address where the sources of contamination are, take action, and when there's a responsible party, is having that responsible party clean up the lead contamination. So that is, in quick summary, what the bill is for and why it came forward.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. And members, there is a fiscal note in our packets. So we get a chance to take a look at that. Are there any questions for members? Representative Halverson.
Well, a couple of things I think for context that are important is this company has been operating for quite a long time in the area, but I believe, and Representative Fisher, I hope that you have some information. Is it a locally owned company now, or is it an international company? And I think that's an important context.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Halverson. I appreciate the question. This is a company that used to be a local company. It was bought a number of years ago. It is owned by a entity in a foreign country.
Okay.
And if I could also add one of the things that I should also mention, thank you, Madam Chair, is that the large number of the children that have been exposed are primarily in lower income communities and are primarily people of color.
Okay, thank you, Representative Fisher. Well, I think this committee should know pretty well what happens to kids who are exposed to lead, and there is no safe level. So,
correct.
Thank you very much. Is this bill brought to us by the Department of Health, Representative Fisher?
The Department of Health did not bring this bill to me, and I think they could speak more accurate, as it's not part of the governor's recommendation. However, this was something we've been working with the agencies on because of multiple areas, so we were trying to get things started early. I don't know if they have anything that they could add at this time.
Nothing
at this time.
All right, the department doesn't want to add. So are there any further questions from members or any discussion? All right, well, seeing none, then House File 4013 is laid over for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget bill. And thank you very much for bringing this, Representative Fisher.
You're welcome, Madam Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for the time. All appreciate right. it.
All right, so we have covered a lot of ground today, and appreciate everyone's help in doing that, and we are adjourned.